Early in his campaign, Barack Obama's education agenda included a long wish list of proposals: early childhood education, dropout prevention, after-school and college outreach programs. He called it his Children First agenda. In the latest installment of our Memo to the President series, NPR's Claudio Sanchez examines what educators want the president-elect to focus on first.
With the economy and life support in just about every state now slashing education funding, President-elect Barack Obama is likely to focus less on his wish list and more on the political consensus that he says he wants to build around education. Here's Mr. Obama last month in Chicago, right before he introduced his nominee for Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan.
For years, we've talked our education problems to death in Washington, but we failed to act, stuck in the same tired debates that have stymied our progress and left schools and parents to fend for themselves. Democrat versus Republican, vouchers versus the status quo, more money versus more reform, all along failing to acknowledge that both sides have good ideas and good intentions. We can't continue like this.
The most important thing that Obama can do right now, which he started doing in that speech, is remind the American people that we have a crisis.
That's Jeanne Allen, head of the Center for Education Reform, which promotes school choice and charter schools in particular. She says Mr. Obama may not be confrontational by nature,
but he has the capacity and the popularity to go out in a dramatic and forceful way, really get everyone's attention, and say, look, we are not going to deal with unions and business as usual anymore. We are not going to allow parents to send their kids to failing schools and be told that wait a few years.
And to do that, says Allen, President-elect Obama must first deal with No Child Left Behind and its future. Many in Congress want to tweak the law. Some want a complete overhaul. Allen says Mr. Obama will come under a lot of pressure to water down the law, but he must protect at all costs two key mandates.
We need to keep the testing in place at the federal level, and we need to make sure that bad schools close if they fail to comply.
It's not clear, though, whether Mr. Obama wants to be heavy-handed in holding states and school districts accountable for students' progress. He has said repeatedly that the law relies too heavily on standardized tests to determine if a school is doing a good job or not. But he also says there should be consequences if failing schools don't improve. Andy Rotherham, a top Obama advisor, says that what the president-elect should avoid is getting bogged down in political skirmishes over No Child Left Behind. Rotherham says it would douse the energy that his education proposals have generated.
And people are really engaging and believing that we can really turn public education into the engine of opportunity that it needs to be. And so the thing that will disappoint people is if that energy and if that excitement isn't translated into really bold action from Washington.
One example of bold action could be a push for merit pay for teachers. Joe Williams, head of Democrats for Education Reform, says it would be a perfect opportunity for Mr. Obama to promote his reform agenda and get teachers on board.
The way that President-elect Obama has talked about a merit pay to reward excellence in teaching, but doing it in a way that isn't seen as anti-teacher is a crucial element to this, which was missing in a lot of the discussions on things like merit pay for a long time.
Whatever he decides to tackle first, Williams says, Mr. Obama needs to get the nation to think in a broader sense about children and what they need. Definitely, says Amy Wilkins of the Education Trust, an advocacy group for low-income minority children. She says if Mr. Obama makes the quality of poor kids' lives, not just their schooling, a priority, he will have done the boldest thing of all.
There has, for so long in this country, been the very sort of strong, overarching story that there are some kids who are so damaged by their circumstances, whether that's poverty, whether that's immigration status, whether that's racism, that there are a set of kids who are so damaged that they can't learn. These are kids who have never been a priority in this country.
Wilkins, though, wonders whether Mr. Obama really has the political will to change that, especially if it comes with a hefty price tag. Which brings us back to Mr. Obama's long wish list for education. Because unless the economy bounces back soon, that's all it is, a wish list. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News.
I was born by the river in a little tent.
When Sam Cooke first sang, "A Change Is Gonna Come," he was keeping the hope of the civil rights movement alive.
It's been a long
Today, those same words and promises still hold strong. Last year, change was the key word in the presidential campaign, and President-elect Barack Obama is charged with making that change happen. The new year also marks a time for us to make changes in our own lives. So, to reflect on the power of words, poet E. Ethelbert Miller joins us to examine the works of past poets and how their words of change and dreams still resonate today. Ethelbert Miller chairs the board of the Institute for Policy Studies and is the director of the African American Resources Center at Howard University. And welcome back.
It's always good to see you.
Happy holidays.
Oh, same to you.
You've written an essay. You're going to share it with us. And you're looking at the work of poet Langston Hughes. First of all, what is it about his work that you most relate to?
I always feel that he's a person who spoke directly to the African-American people and also to America. He also was an international poet. He always has this big smile. You know, he's always jovial. Even when you listen to recordings of his reading, you know, Langston is just a beautiful person. And so I always connected to him. And also his work, which I think is so easy to understand, but so profound at times when you go back and read it a second time.
Would you read the essay?
2008 was a roller coaster ride with its ups and downs. A poor economy, foreclosures, tornadoes, and hurricanes. It bashed our hopes, but hopefully not our dreams. The poet Langston Hughes was our dream keeper. He once wrote, "Bring me all of your dreams, you dreamers. Bring me all of your heart melodies, that I may wrap them in a blue cloud cloth, away from the two rough fingers of the world." Our world is changing, and although the world's fingers are still rough, we still seem to be making wonderful progress. One thing which terrorism, wars, ethnic violence, and hatred cannot stop is the strength that resides inside the human heart and our capacity to love. In January, we will once again celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. We will remember the dream he spoke about back on August 28, 1963. How far have we come? On January 20th, Barack Obama will be sworn in as the 44th President of the United States. It seems as if the time has come to unwrap our dreams, to soften the fingers of this world with songs of peace and hope. When dreams turn into flesh, we discover ourselves. It was Langston Hughes who wrote, "Hold fast to dreams. For if dreams die, life is a broken-winged bird that cannot fly."
Poet E. Ethelbert Miller reading his essay on Langston Hughes. Wonderful verse there. Given that you mentioned the inauguration and it playing such a big part in the metaphor of the poem, he has actually invited poet Elizabeth Alexander to read at the ceremony, and she's only the fourth writer to be asked to read their work as part of a U.S. presidential swearing-in ceremony. If you could choose an African-American female poet from the past that should be thought of at about this time, who would you choose?
Well, I'm very happy that he selected Elizabeth Alexander.
Yes.
That was one person I was highly, you know, recommending a couple of months ago. But because Obama always seems to be making reference to Abraham Lincoln, you know, one would probably go back and look at what African-American woman was popular during the time Lincoln was alive. And that would lead us to Frances Harper. Her voice really captures the voice of the abolitionist, her voice that witnesses slavery. But when we look at the themes that she addresses in terms of religion, freedom, I think her work would be one that one would invite her to read.
Would you read one of her poems?
This is perhaps one of her favorite well-known poems, "Bury Me in a Free Land." "Make me a grave wherever you will, in a lowly plain on a lofty hill. Make it among earth's humblest graves, but not in a land where men are slaves. I could not rest if around my grave I heard the steps of a trembling slave. His shadow above my silent tomb would make it a place of fearful gloom. I could not rest if I heard the tread of a coffle gang to the shambles led, and the mother's shriek of wild despair rise like a curse on the trembling ear. I could not sleep if I saw the lash drinking her blood at each fearful gash, and I saw her babes torn from her breast, like trembling doves torn from their parents' nest. I'd shudder and start if I heard the bay of the bloodhound seething their human prey, and I heard the captive plead in vain as they bound afresh his galling chain. If I saw young girls from their mother's arms bartered and sold for their youthful charms, my eye would flash with a mournful flame, my death-pale cheek grow red with shame. I would sleep, dear friends, with bloated might, can rob no man of his dearest right. My rest shall be calm in any grave, where none can call his brother a slave. I ask no monument, proud and high, to arrest the gaze of the passers-by. All that my yearning spirit craves is bury me not in a land of slaves.
And that's poet E. Ethelbert Miller reading Francis Harper's poem, Bury Me in a Free Land. Ethelbert Miller chairs the board of the Institute for Policy Studies and is director of the African American Resources Center at Howard University. Thanks so much for coming back.
Oh, thank you.
I believe in adaptation.
I believe in a silver lining.
I believe that being flexible keeps me going.
I believe every single person deserves to be acknowledged.
This I believe.
Our This I Believe essay today was sent in by Gina Perosa, who lives on a farm in La Center, Washington. She and her husband have other jobs, too, but on the farm, they raise hay and keep horses. The horses led Perosa to write about her belief. Here's our series curator, independent producer, Jay Allison.
Gina Perosa wrote her essay right after what she says was one of the worst nights of her life. It was a moment she realized that one of her beliefs had limits, and it was up to her to set them. Here is Gina Perosa with her essay for This I Believe.
The architectural term, pathways of desire, refers to dirt ruts in the grass that people make when they want a shortcut between prescribed routes. If you have a yard, you probably have at least a few of them. I live on a farm, and we have dozens. The path between the doghouse and the porch, the tight corner around the house on the south side. Horse trails, the line between one gate and the next. I'm a firm believer in protecting pathways of desire, but I believe we have to be careful of them, too. On one hand, I hate rules. I'm pretty creative about finding ways around them, and I always think twice about thwarting those of others. I respect desire in my children and in the animals on my farm. Their pathways look to me like individual choices, and I respect those. But my respect is double-edged, because pathways of desire can also lead us into trouble. Lately, a pathway of desire has led our horses across what are supposed to be impassable barriers, the cattle guards. They want to come into our yard to eat green grass and apples off the trees before the family can. I understand this desire, even though I feed them bales of hay every day, and it ought to be enough. Well, Saturday night, our oldest horse fell while leaping the cattle guard and broke his hip. We had to put him down and have his carcass hauled away. The other horses watched the drama unfold. Did they learn anything? No. Today they're back in the yard. Thwarting pathways of desire is a constant concern of planners and architects and farmers, too. I'm going to have to pull out and enlarge our cattle guards, excavate deeply under them, paint them bright yellow, and pull a strand of electric fence across them until the horses understand that their pathway of desire isn't available to them anymore. This is hard for me. It goes against my nature, but sometimes I need to modify my belief based on what I've learned. I realize that as a mother, a farmer, and wife, I sometimes must go along with the rules. For instance, my husband and I disagree on a lot. Religion, politics, we don't like the same music. While our pathways of desire might breach our relationship, we put up a cattle guard and we stay obediently on our own sides. It mostly works. Boundaries are necessary sometimes. Enforcing them takes a lot more effort than it ought to. I believe you have to choose your pathway of desire with care. Get it wrong, and the consequences might be fatal. My old horse and I learned this the hard way.
Gina Perosa with her essay for This I Believe. Perosa told us that the snow has been so deep lately that it covered the cattle guards, and the horses began crossing them again. She and her husband had to put the electric fence back up. As we enter the new year, we want to repeat our invitation to write an essay for our series and submit it at npr.org. For This I Believe, I'm Jay Allison.
Jay Allison is co-editor with Dan Gettiman, John Gregory, and Vicki Merrick of the book This I Believe, Volume 2, More Personal Philosophies of Remarkable Men and Women.
Support for This I Believe comes from Prudential Retirement.
To make sense of the worsening economy, it may help to look to the past. If you want to see how the dot-com crash of 2000 was covered on the Internet, then boot up the Wayback Machine. David Kushner, our digital culture commentator, is here to explain. Hey, David.
Hey, how are you?
Now, I remember the Wayback Machine from the old Sherman and Mr. Peabody cartoons. You're not talking about the same thing, are you?
Not the same thing, though. It is inspired by that in name. But the Wayback Machine is basically like a time machine for the Internet, and it lets you see old web pages that may no longer be around. So you go to the site. You can find it at archive.org, and what you do is basically type in a website address, and then you click a button that says Take Me Back, and it does take you back, and you see snapshots of the site as it looked on specific dates going back as far as 1996. So you might use it to look at historical events like surfing newspapers and blogs, say on 9/11 or even the day of the dot-com crash. And you could also look at personal home pages. I'm a fan of the band Radiohead, so I went back and found their site from 1997. I found my own site from 2003. You can even use it to look at sites of people who are deceased and maybe their sites are no longer online now. So this is really the one of the only ways we have of going back.
How many old web pages are in the archives?
Right now, the count is at about 85 billion web pages, which is a lot. And it's actually, to get really geeky and technical about it, it's 2 petabytes of data growing at a rate of 20 terabytes per month. So it exceeds the text in the world's largest libraries, including the Library of Congress.
How does a site wind up in these archives?
Well, there are a couple ways. One way is that there's a robot on the Internet called Alexa, and it crawls around and it stores public websites and archives them. People can also submit their own sites to get archived. It takes about 8 weeks once you submit your site for it to get crawled, and then it takes about another 6 months for it to go online. Of course, there are some people who just don't want their sites at all archived for whatever reason, and you can actually set up your site so that it won't get stored on the Wayback Machine.
What do you see as the significance of this?
You know, it taps into this larger idea about the ephemeral nature of our lives online and the steps that we now have to take to really preserve our history because, you know, we spend so much time on the Internet. We're gaming online, we're communicating online, and we're not really leaving as many paper trails anymore. We're essentially leaving pixel trails, and this is part of the effort to save them.
David Kushner writes for Rolling Stone and Wired. His latest book, Levittown, will be published in February. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
The manufacturing sector of the U.S. economy has hit its lowest level in 28 years. The Institute for Supply Management, a trade group for purchasing executives, reported Friday that manufacturing activity in all industry sectors plummeted, another sign of the current recession. Joining us by phone is Nigel Gault. He's the chief U.S. economist for IHS Global Insight, an economic research and forecasting firm. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Is it any surprise to you that manufacturing is in such a bad slump?
Unfortunately not, based on what we've been seeing over the past few months. Manufacturing in the U.S. had been heading down for some time now, but not catastrophically. Unfortunately, over the last few months, this recession has broadened out to cover all sectors in the U.S. economy and also the global economy. And that's now taking down exports, on which manufacturing had previously been relying to prop things up.
So everything is going down globally. It's not just the United States having an effect on that, or is it everyone's having problems?
The biggest problem is the origin of the problem. Yes, we can say that's in the United States, but it's much, much broader than that now. It's really very, very hard to find anywhere in the world that you can say is not taking part in what looks like the worst global recession in the post-war era.
How big a role is manufacturing actually playing in this recession?
The manufacturing sector, by its nature, is very cyclical. It produces a lot of durable goods, which means things that you can easily postpone the purchase of. For example, an automobile or a firm considering a purchase of capital equipment. You can decide, I'm not going to do it this year, I'm going to wait a bit until things improve. So, as always in recessions, manufacturing is more cyclical, tends to take more pain than other parts of the economy.
Now, what effect will this have on people who maybe don't have anything to do with the manufacturing sector, they don't work there? How is this going to affect the ordinary citizen?
Well, if manufacturing is going down, then it means that the people who work in manufacturing, maybe they lose their jobs, or maybe they're working less overtime, or maybe they're forced to work part-time instead of full-time. They have less income, and if they have less income, then they spend less, so that any businesses, maybe in the service sector, who rely on the spending from people employed in manufacturing, they will see the demand for their products go down as well.
What are the industries that have been hardest hit? I mean, we know about the auto industry in the United States, but what are some of the others?
Well, in the early stages, it was industries that were, you know, very closely related to housing. And what we're starting to see now is industries that may have been helped up until recently by export demand. That might be machinery, heavy equipment, particularly construction machinery. They are now seeing demand evaporating as well.
Does it strike you as manufacturing is kind of another domino falling in a long line?
I think so, yes, absolutely. And you sort of wonder, what other dominoes are there to go? I think the next domino to go in quite a big way is probably going to be non-residential construction, a building of offices, building of retail malls, etc., which up until recently that's held up pretty well, but all the signs are that is going to go down very heavily over the next year or so.
Nigel Gault is the chief economist for IHS Global Insight. He joined us by phone from his home in Bedford, Massachusetts. Thank you so much.
Thank you.